So, retrospectors, what historical events are we ticking off on this week's run of Today in History?
Well, Tuesday is the anniversary of the first Tarzan movie to hit the silver screen.
Then on Wednesday, we tell the story of how Gottlieb Daimler inadvertently invented the motorbike.
On Thursday, we explain how MSG got demonized in the 1960s.
And on Friday, we revisit a legendary battle on a frozen Russian lake.
We discuss this and more on Today in History with the retrospectors. 10 minutes each weekday, wherever you get your podcasts.
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. How to get 30, 30, how to get 30, how to get 20, 20, 20, how to get 20, 20, how to get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month? Sold!
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/newsadfree. That's amazon.com/newsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Welcome to the Media Podcast. I'm Ollie Mann. On today's show, it's the end of the affair as Jeremy Clarkson leaves the BBC. Where will he go? As the UK general election campaign gets underway, Paxman says the broadcasters have been terrible negotiators. Is he right? Plus, there's a new editor of The Guardian. Indies air their grievances and Facebook wants to host newsgroups content. But at what cost? This is the Media Podcast, sponsored by Audioboo. And with me today at the Hospital Club is the radio consultant and creative director of Folder Media. It is Matt Deegan. Hello, Matt.
Hello.
At the time of recording, you are waiting to find out whether the digital bid that you are part of has actually won the license, but you don't yet know, and your phone's on airplane mode.
Absolutely. I've given out my email. We should know this is the second national commercial multiplex for digital radio. It is either the Listen to Digital bid, which is a variety of stations from new entrants, or the old bunch of normal media types, Arqiva, Bauer and UTV,
who said put something together, far less charitable off air.
Who put together a solid bid as well.
Okay, but if the bid comes through and you win whilst we're recording, all the beers are on you, that's
yes,
clear.
Yes, absolutely.
Okay, good to hear. Also joining us for his media podcast debut, it is the broadcaster and DJ, Edward Adu. Hello, Ed.
Good afternoon, how are you doing? You're good?
I'm very well, thank you. You've worked for them all, you've had them all, Five Live, More Four, now the media podcast.
It's great to be here, you know, I've been just knocking on that door saying, I need to be here, I want to be part of this podcast. So it's a great moment.
I know the feeling. I started here basically as work experience, worked my way up. Give us a flavour of your week, Ed. What have you been up to?
I did a narration for a BBC Three show. That's on next week.
Oh, yeah.
And so I did an update for that, and I met the actor Colin McFarlane in the studios, and he's a really cool guy. So I think that was the highlight of my week. And DJ'd in Bristol last weekend, trekked on a mega bus as you do, came back on a mega bus.
I asked you for a highlight.
Sorry,
of the week.
You didn't ask me, what have you been doing all week? So I'm thinking, listen, you know, I might as well give you the full lowdown.
Everyone has been talking about the three middle-aged white men on BBC Two. What is going to happen to Top Gear? Well, we have found out Jeremy Clarkson's contract will not be renewed. The BBC have confirmed that that is the case. After what internal investigator Ken Macquarie described as a 30-second physical assault on a Top Gear producer over the lack of hot food served at their hotel, that really did happen. The report says it's the case. The Director General, Tony Hall, has decided that was the final straw. Ed, you just said you work at the BBC from time to time, don't we all?
Yeah, no, and
did they have any other choice but to fire him?
They didn't. And give you a quick story. Lenny Henry, in light of his BAFTA speech, I got in contact with Danny Cohen one Sunday morning, and I didn't expect to get a reply from Danny, and I did within 40 minutes, and he connected me with loads of execs, which has led to lots of opportunities. Danny Cohen gets it. It's about representing the audience, and unfortunately I think Clarkson is one of those kind of old school beasts who thinks that, you know, he's very kind of 1984 BBC, I have the power and it's going to be on my terms. And I think he's, with this aspect, he's hit the line. And Danny Cohen and Lord Hall rightly said, especially Danny Cohen's comments in the, I think it was The Guardian or The Telegraph, where he says, you know, no one's bigger than the football team. And he's got every right to say that. And I think the right decision has been made.
But actually, you know, when you talk about Clarkson being out of line with, you know, the way the BBC maybe presents itself, we're in danger, aren't we, of conflating what he said in the past on air, which is sometimes, you know, off colour and actually sometimes racist, and what he's done this time and actually punched someone. I mean, they're two different things, aren't
they? Punch someone and acting in that manner, in a sense, if you work for the BBC, I believe that you are a public servant. I think he was given too much power in terms of ratings, in terms of the enterprise, with the actual brand. It got to his head. If you've got problems going on at home, going through a divorce, or if anything's happening, you don't take it out with your producer. And if that happened to anyone else in the workplace, if someone working at Tesco's or a bus driver or a tube driver, whatever, they'd be dismissed straight away. And the unions wouldn't, you know, it wouldn't be a Bob Crowe's an announcement saying we're going on strike, because the unions would know that they wouldn't have a leg to stand on. So they would have to go.
I think for me, what was fascinating reading the short summary of the investigation was that the producer who got his lip split by Jeremy Clarkson drove himself to A&E to be seen. And number one, you think, everyone else heard that. What kind of pull would someone like Jeremy Clarkson have that the person who is assaulted is not driven by someone else who works on that show, but drives himself to do it?
And also, it takes Clarkson himself to report himself.
Well, this is it. This is the other thing, is that producer seemingly did not report it and just got on with it. Because my assumption would be, reading that, you know, if you work on a big production like that, that the talent are important, and, you know, you're part of your job, though unfairly, is there to take it. How sad that that's the case.
Indeed. And Ed, as a presenter, you know, well, like me, I guess you've been in situations, obviously on a much smaller scale than Top Gear, as you say, Matt, it's a massively popular show, but you've been in situations where you've been on a shoot all day, and Giles Corran was articulating this excellently on the media show last week. Everyone else on the set is eating and drinking. You're waiting all day thinking, I'm going to have my hot meal at the end of the day. You are treated nicely by everyone. Runners are bringing you tea and coffee and all the rest of it. Does the media create these monsters?
I think they do. And I think we're in the age now where I think those monsters are dying. And I think Clarkson's one of those. You end up somewhere else, but I think in terms of the BBC, it's about respect. It's about morals at the end of the day. It doesn't matter if you're a big broadcaster or personality or whatever. At the end of the day, it's about respect. If you're given that amount of power, and if you disrespect people in that kind of aspect, then it's worrying to think what else, you know, could happen.
You know, some of the people who've been arrested over the past year for terrible things that they've done, illegal things that they've done, you know, a lot of that comes from people who are never told no, or always get away with it, or it's hidden because there's a perception that it's more important that they carry on doing their thing. And that ends up being positive reinforcement. If you sleaze over a colleague or sexually harass someone or do even worse, but even though you know your bosses know, they're not telling you off for it, well, that's, you then keep repeating it. And we've seen it, the stuff in the papers, particularly on sexual allegations, but this is a version of that, isn't it? You've got away with it. If you've got away with it forever, you don't even consider it a problem, when clearly, looking at this, it's totally unacceptable.
And therefore, if Netflix, as is reported, or possibly ITV, swoop in and sign up not just Clarkson, but possibly also Hammond and May, and steal what is essentially the format away from the BBC, even though they'll still have the rights to the title, are those immoral companies? You know, if someone's done a bad thing and then they're punished, is it immoral to swoop in and say, well, here's more money?
I'm sure we'll have an apology from Clarkson to the producer, a public one, and a very, you know, appearing on a sofa somewhere. Actually, if he's sensible, he'll say the BBC was right to sack me. I've acted on, yeah, is go for the forgiveness and then reemerge as a £100 million Netflix series. If I was Netflix, I would be looking at that as a property going, yeah, we'd like that one, thanks. That this translates to our new business model. I'm finding we can get over the small hump. They'll do it.
But then, you know, should your whole career be over because of one mistake, which actually at the moment hasn't gone to the police, you know, he hasn't been charged for, it's just something that he handed himself over and said I made a mistake.
Yeah, I think he's going to have to do a whole mea culpa.
Yeah, which we'll all look forward to watching, let's be honest. Right, this week also marks the beginning of the oft-discussed TV debates. They are happening. By the time you hear this, they may have already started, as Channel 4 and Sky News are showing the first TV debate on Thursday. Matt Paxo is in the chair, another Jeremy. He said in the build-up that the broadcasters overplayed their hand, sort of buggered up the whole negotiation, really, with the TV debates. Is he right?
I imagine that the TV producers thought they would get further than they did and probably felt they had the public on their side and could railroad it, which isn't a terrible strategy, actually, to get it to happen. I think what they didn't expect was the advice that David Cameron's had about how terrible, or the options it brings up would be terrible for him. And even though Cameron looks awful not doing these debates, it is still better than standing next to Ed Miliband.
And lending him more credibility.
Yeah.
I mean, from that point of view, do you think the public will engage with the debates on their own terms? Or do you think a lot of the public are going to be watching it thinking, oh, Cameron's a chicken, he's not standing up to Miliband, this isn't the debate we wanted to see?
No, I think the public want to see a full debate, and they want to see Cameron, they want to see Miliband, they want to see everyone present. Having a public platform is the perfect way to get out there and to kind of tell people what you want to put in place. I think that's essential.
Except what Paxman was saying was, you know, the broadcasters are behaving as this is an absolutely integral part of British politics, and indeed Ed Miliband now says he's going to legislate for it, doesn't he? But actually, we've only had TV debates since 2010. It was legitimate for the Prime Minister to say, I don't want to do it.
Well, if you go back to the 60s when there was first American TV debates, they had them, and then they went away for a few years, for a few election cycles, and then they came back. In America, they have a debates committee that actually does the organising, and that's probably a much better way of doing it, whether that's an Electoral Reform Society-esque operator who creates that. And I think already it's complex with TV companies trying to work together to outsmart the other broadcasters. They're playing against each other themselves. Suddenly YouTube and The Telegraph pop up going, oh no, we're the new face of debating. I mean, part of me, if I was a politician, would be thinking all I'm going to do is be in TV studios next to these same people. So maybe putting an independent group together to choose some sort of thing. I think from a public policy perspective, talking about politics, to turn down the opportunity to explain your manifestos to the public in a not a stage managed environment, it's kind of terrible. They've chosen not to do that. They'd rather sit on the sofa or have Paxman one-on-one doing it.
And yet, in a way, the real kind of decision swaying stuff might not happen on telly at all, but might be on social media anyway.
I think people will explode on social media. I mean, we will see more tired after wandering down streets all day, knocking on doors, and
doing a Thornbury, in other words.
Having the public shouting at them, and then suddenly tweeting the wrong things. I don't think there'll be anybody at UKIP left by the end of the campaign if, like, social media has its way.
I'm sure we'll see more tweets or something along the lines of saying, "Get your flags down," and they'll be, "Oh, I'm sorry, I didn't mean that."
Right, well, just before we head to the break, Wednesday also saw the reveal of Broadcast Magazine's annual Indie Survey results, where independent companies air their dirty linen and speak openly about broadcasters and the state of the industry. Jake Cantor, friend of the pod from Broadcast, is here to fill us in.
So here's three things you need to know about Broadcast's Indie Survey. One of the key trends we've seen this year is actually growth in the UK production sector slowing slightly. UK production companies posted revenues of about £2.3 billion last year, which was about 9% growth on 2013, which is not as fast a rate of growth as has been in previous years. Now, we think that's for a couple of reasons. We think that opportunities for commissions in the UK are slowing down somewhat, and there are fewer places to go and get shows away. Broadcasters are being more selective about what they commission. The other thing is that some of the big production companies at the top end of the market may have slightly taken their eye off the ball a little bit last year. So you have All3Media, which was bought by Discovery and Liberty Global. That was a big deal. Perhaps there was less focus on creativity. You also had the coming together of Endemol, Shine and Core Media, which was a huge seismic deal, which we haven't really seen what kind of impact that will have. But inevitably, those businesses would have had one eye on that consolidation and perhaps not on creativity. Second of all, we had the first real production sector verdict on the BBC's plans to commercialise its in-house production division. The industry is sort of broadly split down the middle. About 98 big production companies, independent producers making big shows, answered this question, and about 56% of them said they were supportive, 15% said they were indifferent, and the rest were not massively happy about the idea of this. Finally, we've done a bit of research examining how the Indie Survey shapes up this year compared to 5 years ago. And one of the key things we've seen is the growth of US ownership. So if you look at the market in 2011, American companies accounted for about 5% of revenue in the UK production sector. They now account for 44%, which is the largest of any country, including the UK. Of course, instead of hearing me gabbling on, you can pick up your copy of Broadcast and read all about the Indie Survey in this week's issue.
That was Jake Cantor. We'll have more stories after this.
This episode of the Media Podcast is brought to you by Squarespace, the all-in-one hosting and website creator that gives you all you need to showcase your content. Squarespace uses your own browser window to build your website, no downloads required, and provides templates to suit all styles and tones. They also have e-commerce solutions, which I believe means that you can sell things through your site, and 24-hour support from offices in the US and UK. For a free 2-week trial with no credit card required, go to squarespace.com now. And if you like what you get and want 10% off a subscription, just use the offer code MEDIAPOD at the checkout.
Now, I don't know about you, but my Sunday afternoons as a child were going to visit my Jewish grandmother in Hendon, her making me a load of bridge rolls with salmon and cream cheese, me eating far too many of them, then getting into a Land Rover driven by my dad, in which we listened to the Radio 1 chart show, presented by Mark Goodyear, and sometimes I was literally physically sick because of the combination of thumping beats and bridge rolls. Well, Radio 1 have just pissed all over my childhood. Matt, why is this happening? They're moving the top 40 away from Sunday.
So the record companies internationally have decided that the release dates for new music will be Fridays globally, which suddenly having a chart on a Sunday means that you're not having a week, or you've got a week and a half, and it's all got very confusing. So Radio 1 are going to move their chart from Sundays 4 to 7 to be part of Greg James's show on a Friday. What's kind of interesting, I think there's a few different interesting bits about this. One, is the chart relevant? Well, 1.3 million people listen to it on Radio 1 each week, and 2.3 million people listen to the Big Top 40, which is the commercial competitor. So, you know, nearly 4 million people have decided that on a Sunday afternoon, bridge rolls or not, they would like to listen.
I'd recommend the combination.
Like to listen to it.
It's got to be with Goodyear.
I think it is in a changing world. It's difficult to justify the chart. But I was reading a great blog by Adam Bowie, actually, who is a BBC strategist. And on his private blog, he was saying, why don't we actually replicate what movie studios do and kind of have an opening weekend for a song? So if it comes out on a Friday, let's keep the chart on a Sunday, but let's sort of reflect its most buzzy time. And I thought, actually, that's quite a modern, neat idea, rather than waiting. But charts, do we need them if there is always a chart on iTunes that is saying what the most popular song is right now?
Well, so the answer is no, we probably don't need them, but people like the chart show. The question is, will they like it on a Friday, do you think, Ed? Because it is part of the routine. I know it's mostly kids listening, and they haven't built up necessarily that familiarity listening every Sunday, and their habits can be changed. But the fact that it's continuously been on air for so many decades on a Sunday, moving it to a Friday, do you want to hear a chart then?
I think Ben Cooper's done a good and a wise thing, especially as Radio 1 are trying to target more of a younger demographic. So I think in terms of trying to get that CBBC audience and to maintain or retain the current Radio 1 audience, Friday at 4 o'clock is perfect. Drive time, people on their way home, it's after the school run. But in terms of the competition with the commercials, this is where Radio 1 may have a problem. It's like, what are they going to actually put in place in order to target, as Matt rightly said, about the 2.3 million? What can they do? I read something that they're going to do something along the lines of a CBBC style content.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous 2-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass? So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
With LinkedIn Jobs, we tap into a network of more than a billion professionals to help you find quality professionals quickly and easily for any role you need. Marketing wizards? Found them.
Software engineers?
Found.
That project manager I could never seem to hire?
And found.
LinkedIn Jobs quickly matches your roles with candidates with the right skills and experience. In fact, 86% of small businesses get a qualified candidate within 24 hours. Post your first job for free and get started at linkedin.com/spoken. That's linkedin.com/spoken. Terms and conditions apply.
Hey everyone, I'm Craig Robinson, co-host of the Ways to Win podcast, alongside my good friend John Calipari. I've been on the go recently, Phoenix, Kansas City, Chicago. If you're like me and have a home but aren't always at home, you have an Airbnb. Hosting your home or a spare room is a very practical side hustle. If you live in a big game town, you can Airbnb your place for fans to stay in. Your home might be worth more than you think. Find out how much at airbnb.com/host.
Between 4 and 7. But I mean, is the chart relevant? It is. I mean, look at streaming, Kendrick Lamar, you know, number one album. It got a lot of hype. A lot of people were like, I'm not sure about Kendrick Lamar. There were the real hip hop heads got into it. The bubblegum hip hop heads were like, oh no, this is very political. But it still got streamed. And you got a number one album. So trends are changing. It's more accessible. And I think it's a good thing.
And one of the trends that has changed, though, is that there is a broader palette of people buying singles, I guess, because, you know, streaming is built into it. As you say, things that were considered niche in the past, like hip-hop or whatever it is, are now considered mainstream if enough people listen to it or download it in a week. With that in mind, Matt, is it a good idea to be simulcasting a CBBC show? Doesn't that sort of say the charts are for kids?
Yeah, well, I think they probably always have been to a certain extent in different forms. You know, backing your favourite artist, you know, fandoms. It's usually popular with kind of teen acts and those sorts of things. The people who want their act to do better than someone else is probably the younger end. A measurement of music success, I think, is nice to have. But does it need to be a radio show? So, talking to someone who's more in the target demo, and they were saying, well, if you listen to the top 40, you know, 20 to 40 are old songs that, you know, stick around quite a long time. Mm.
John Legend, forever.
Yeah, so the top 20 is a bit more relevant as well, which the new Radio 1 Friday was going to concentrate on. The first chart on Radio 1, I think, was on a Tuesday. So it's moving to Sunday was, I think, in the 80s. So it's not something that's been around forever. Though the one thing I would say is it's the one show everyone knows what time it's on, probably on the radio. Mm. So whether that's commercial or BBC, like, you know, at 4 o'clock it's the chart, and that before seven there is the number one. Mm. And it's the radio programme says it's a bit of a shame to abandon the last kind of appointment to listen.
And what about Top of the Pops? Because as a brand, people have been saying for years, and I know it was tainted by Savile and all the rest to an extent, but again, it was part of everyone's sort of growing up and childhood. People miss Top of the Pops. Is this a missed opportunity, bringing a new show about music rather than Top of the Pops back to BBC One?
I think
CBBC, or is that just me being nostalgic again?
It's definitely being nostalgic. I think, you know, CBBC has more relevance, not only for its audience who watch it, but people from the 10 years above who kind of understand, you know, what it is. Top of the Pops was great when the only way to watch music on television was between 7 and 7:30 on a Thursday or Friday. Not the way anymore, you know. Music TV channels, if you want music, it is on all the time. You know, we don't need to see that in that one place.
But Ed, it was different though, wasn't it? Top of the Pops, the live performance, you know, the sense of seeing what the stars look like. I know what Matt's saying, of course you can watch the music videos, but it's different somehow watching them dress up for their Top of the Pops thing. And you see the way people react to the MTV Awards and the Brits. People do still like that, the X Factor. Is there a place for a mainstream pop show still? Because what we've got is Jules Holland and The Culture Show and Jonathan Ross, you know, little places where people play music. Andrew Marr, for goodness sake. Why can't we have a pop show back?
Sunday brunch.
Their
little clips.
Yeah.
We've got so many music channels out there. And I think in terms of having that one platform that showcases loads of music, it'd be great for it to come back. And I think you're right. I think the whole kind of panache with Top of the Pops is seeing people doing crazy stuff, you know, growing up. When I was about 6 or 7, watching Farley Jackmaster Funk when he did Love Won't Turn Around, I remember saying to my mum, is that guy's hair real? I mean, he had the craziest jerry curl, and I thought his hair was about to explode. But it's moments like that which will stick, you know, at the back of my mind, that was what I saw on Top of the Pops. So it'd be great for a show like Top of the Pops to be on weekly, whether it be at a Beeb or on a commercial platform. And we can take the mick out of the artist and say, look, they've got crazy jerry curls.
Well, we've sort of got it. It's called the X Factor Sunday Show. You know, that has two or three artists.
Yeah, you're right. It's definitely Sunday.
And you get performances. It's not just whatever.
X Factor Sunday. I mean, the big promotion, the big build on that. It's incredible. I mean, I don't know anyone who doesn't watch it. Even the cynics. The X Factor cynics, they're like, okay, I'm going to watch it for 10 minutes. And then you see the Twitter feeds. Like, I don't watch this program. In actual fact,
but
you
what
do.
But what is Rihanna wearing?
Yeah, exactly. You just tweeted about it.
Okay, well, moving on from what I think is the only ever reference to Farley Jack Master Funk we've ever had on the media podcast, although Maggie Brown may have mentioned it once in incident. Let's talk about The Sun. Four of their journalists cleared on Friday of paying public officials, which is rare good news for the tabloid. Chief reporter John Kay, royal editor Duncan Larkham, executive editor Fergus Shanahan, and the deputy editor Jeff Webster, all found not guilty. Matt, lots of discussion in the press this week about whether Operation Elverdon, which is the Met Police's dedicated investigation into the press paying officials, has actually just been a complete waste of time and resources.
It would seem that from looking at the results of a lot of the cases. There's a bit about from the CPS, should they be taking all these cases to court if they don't seem to be able to win any of them.
But also, as Roy Greenslade pointed out in his Guardian piece about this, ignorance of something being a crime isn't an excuse, obviously, but genuinely, it's not like with phone hacking where everyone knew they were probably doing something they shouldn't. In the case of this, you know, people didn't even realise it was a crime to offer a public official some money. I mean, is that something that actually needs to be trained into journalists from earlier stage?
Absolutely. I mean, it came out in a select committee, didn't it, when Rebecca Brooks inadvertently said that she paid police officers before she was nudged and had clearly just never considered that was a problem before.
I think it's down to training. Again, it's that whole rule book of the in-house kind of procedural. If you're going to get a story, you need to do it the right way and you need to be told how to do it. But again, I don't think there was anyone guiding those journalists or telling them, listen, this is what you should do and this is what you shouldn't do.
I mean, I think it's interesting that if you think about journalists being shouted at by their backbench, they wear these stories, all that kind of stuff, and that they know that in those organisations that other journalists have hacked phones or paid people off, and you know that your bosses seem to turn a blind eye to that. You know, to get your boss off the back, do you start doing some of these things?
Well, if you're reading the press these days, chances are you are actually reading it on social media or at least clicking through from social media to their website. And now we know that Facebook are looking to host news content for partner media companies. They're actually going to team up with the New York Times and National Geographic, initially, a few other illustrious titles as well. Why?
There's a couple of ways of looking at it. You can kind of go, a lot of those one-click links to websites don't actually provide that much value to a publisher. If they don't stick around, they don't look at any other articles, okay, there are some ad views there at the same time, but the sort of the income you get from that casual reader, not that valuable. The Times, The Sun, you know, now paywalls the material anyway. They're not even bothered getting that sort of data. Mm. So if the traffic isn't worth that much, keeping it on Facebook's site makes it super fast for people to get into it. They're in your brand environment. Potentially, you'll rev share some of the money. Maybe Facebook can sell it a better CPM than you. Maybe that is the right decision. But kind of as a website owner, do I want to become like, this is like AOL circa 1995, where you know you have to visit the Times or whatever, keyword Times in Facebook to read all the material. I think it's potentially a dangerous gamble. Though I think if you can cleverly monetize it, you know, if you're running video content and you're getting, again, higher CPMs on Facebook video pre-roll, well, actually you do want to keep people in that environment. If you can make more money or get a better relationship with users, do something else. There's a bit in the paper about all the tracking that websites do with users that you obviously would lose out all the benefits of the cookies and all that kind of stuff. You know, most big websites are so bad at coping with all the massive amounts of data they collect about their users. Mm. In the real world, it'll make bugger all difference to their businesses.
But you're right in terms of time and expense, though. You know, I know that there may be profit coming as a result, but if you're a small organisation, and we made this point last episode when we were talking about Snapchat, OK, you're already tailoring content to Facebook, but this is yet another way where you're going to have to tailor your content, and it can lead, I guess, to a lack of focus there.
Also, Facebook can change the algorithm, so you can work really, really hard to create stories which appear in news feeds or are better accessed or whatever the new metric is, and then their mind changes and someone games the system normally, so then alter the metric, and all that hard work you've put into getting your stuff into the system kind of changes. A lot of it actually comes back to, you know, the true value of a media company is creating the right content and getting people to it. And kind of clickbait articles is great short term, but it's not good for building any kind of business.
Right, to the US now. James Corden making his debut this week as the new host of The Late Late Show on CBS. It was received pretty well, although he had some help from some pretty top-notch guests there, Tom Hanks and Mila Kunis, on the first show. How do you think he did? Have you seen any of the show?
Yeah, I thought he did well. And, you know, I think in terms of his appearance, we've all got this thing about people looking skinny, and James is not. He's just kind of this rounded type, sort of beer belly type geezer, and he gets away with it. And I think he's opened the door, and I think he's saying to not just to the Brits but to the Americans that, listen, it's not about appearance. You don't have to be this kind of bronze, golden, tanned, six-pack type person, but if you've got the charisma and the personality, you can cut it. And I think he's going to do well.
I think there's an interesting question about what his thing is. You need a thing, of course, if you're doing, well, he's either sarcastic one, either nice one, either whatever. And actually, watching the first couple of shows, he comes over as very real and humble. Mm. And that's, and I don't, I think a little bit of, not put on, but I think they are emphasising that.
It is a little bit put on. He's an actor, isn't he? I think it's reasonable to say it's a little bit put on. We know he can be obnoxious as well.
But I think they've chosen to make that his distinctive quality.
Yeah.
And it does kind of cut through. Like, looking at some of the social responses, especially from Americans who have no idea who he is, surprisingly well received for a new thing, which you're always just kind of slagged off good or bad. They had some good sketches on the first one. So I saw last night, which was the second episode, he did quite a funny thing delivering pizzas to real Americans and doing like silly things in their houses. I mean, the bit that I watch it for, where they've sort of borrowed other people's format types. Obviously, you've got a bit of Graham Norton. Mm. You've got a bit of Don't Forget Your Toothbrush. There's a bit of TFI Friday. Yeah, a bit of Jonathan Ross, bit of TFI Friday. And they're trying to bring those things to a very staid format in America, where you've got two talk shows a night across most of the channels.
Also hosted by men called James.
Yeah, on most of the channels, yeah. Doing the same stuff. And I think they're trying to do something a little bit different. Okay, two nights in, who knows where it will go. He's a bit uncomfortable on the old interviews, but I'm sure he'll get there.
I think if he comes across with that kind of Jonathan Ross flavour, I certainly think, you know, it's going to be good times for him. And I think, you know, what you're saying, Matt, about him being real and being humble, if he can relate to the Americans in that manner, then certainly it's a winner. It's going to be gold all the way for him.
It is bizarre, though, how many British presenters go over to the States. I know Piers Morgan didn't last too long, but, you know, you've the likes
Robinson,
of
Robinson.
Yeah. Cat Deeley.
Yes.
I mean, it's... We don't have nearly as many Americans on our screens.
Well, we wouldn't allow it, would we?
No,
to do any of our
not present shiny floor shirts.
Yeah. Yeah. But even like Huey Green of the past, obviously American.
He's Canadian, people. I think. Okay. Actually, Huey Green.
Yeah,
but
American.
Still, the accent is there. Yeah.
And probably the last major one that really cut through. They're much more welcoming than we are. I'm always shocked how few people watch all these programs. So I was looking at the consolidated overnights, and he did 1.3 million, which, you know, from 1:30 to 1:30 in the mornings, probably actually not too bad. But like some BBC Three shows are probably doing better than that in the UK, with probably significantly less budget than he's got.
Yeah, I don't know what your concern about overnights is, Matt. I think you'll find that is peak time. Right, there is just time finally for the media quiz. This week it is entitled Elevator Pitch. Silence. I will sell you a news story in the style of a Hollywood movie synopsis, and from that you will have to work out what happened this week which closely resembles the pitch. Buzz in with your name. The winner gets a second kitchen.
Can I make a sound effect like, Edward?
It's your first appearance on the show. You're not here to innovate, okay? Just Ed. Right, here's my elevator pitch number one. It's like the thick of it in space. It's like the thick of it in space. What's the news story this week that resembles that elevator pitch?
Oh, Ed. Arnaldo. Is it Arnaldo Iannucci?
You're close. Yes, close. Arnaldo Iannucci. Yes. What's
and,
the story?
Oh,
it's a bit like doing a quiz when drunk. So, Matt, come on, you can step in here. You can see this point.
Amanda Nietzsche makes Veep.
Yes.
And he's...
What's in space? Who is in space? Doctor Who is in space,
yes,
for
said,
goodness sake.
He said that he would like to...
Say your name.
He's getting Matt.
Right.
Amanda Nietzsche's going to write an episode of Doctor Who.
He said he'd like to write an episode of Doctor Who. That was piss poor from both of you. You're getting half a point each. Half a point each on that. Right, elevator pitch number two. Okay. Father of three, Peter, and his family are threatened with eviction. Oh, you're coming in early, but all right, let me finish the finish the question. Father of three, Peter, and his family are threatened with eviction and end up living with Keith Lemon and H from Steps.
ITV2 have signed up Family Guy. Gotta get up early to get me on comedy quiz-based questions. This is after sensationally revealing they were after Family Guy by decorating a door in the ITV Centre that someone took a photo of on Twitter.
Yeah, which you wonder whether that was almost deliberate because it was so stupid.
Well, they apparently decorate doors when they are pitching for things.
Oh, so it's a way of saying to the execs who are coming in,
yes.
Hey, we like you.
Yes.
The next time I'm there, I'm doing a voiceover, then I'm going to do some snooping.
Well, maybe they'll have you on the door, like, welcome to the ITV Centre. Yeah.
If you ever go into ITV and there's a big picture of you on their elevator, that's a good sign, as if you didn't know.
It's not me.
Right, so 1.5 points to Matt, half a point to Ed. Here's elevator pitch number three. The rags-to-riches story of a woman in a man's world, a state school kid with dreams of global domination, the underdog in a race she eventually wins after finding herself in Australia.
Matt. Is this Salma Hayek?
No. Who's recently been to Australia, who's a woman in a man's world? Someone who's recently been appointed to a job. If neither of you know, then Matt wins the quiz. And this is, I think, the worst edition of the Media Podcast quiz we've ever had. Okay.
Australian.
I'm going to give it to Matt, because my
brain very generous of you and your ignorance. Unbelievable.
This is where it's all gone wrong now.
Ed has flopped.
Matt, congratulations. You've won the quiz this episode.
I feel I should almost return the prize for poor quality quizmanship.
Absolutely terrible. So the answer, to put you both out of your misery, is that Catherine Viner has become The Guardian's new editor-in-chief.
Yes, we
having
that.
Served at Guardian Australia.
Yes.
And much made in the press about the fact that she did go to a state school and she is a woman, which shouldn't really be a big deal, but it is on Fleet Street.
I feel that the quiz has transitioned from being more like the This Morning quiz into being only Connect.
I like that, yeah.
I'm more used to the, is it A, a banana, B, the Prime Minister, or C, an apple, those sorts of questions.
Well, if This Morning were interested in going in a new direction, I might pitch that to them, only Connect style quiz, if my face gets on the list.
Or you see, they crack the door and you're there.
Right, well, thank you very much anyway, despite your efforts towards the end. Thank you, Ed. Thank you, Matt.
Thank you.
Remember, you can hear new episodes as soon as they're ready by subscribing to us at themediapodcast.com. We are also on Twitter at The Media Podcast, or you can like our page on Facebook. Today's show is dedicated to Alan Hill, who describes himself as that British bloke in deepest New Jersey, and to Gary Bembridge, travel author, writer, video maker, and podcaster at tipsfortravellers.com. I've been Ollie Mann, the producer, Matt Hill. Until next time, bye-bye.
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/newsadfree. That's amazon.com/newsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.